Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business. And on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet. I wanted to take a second to tell you about our season two sponsor, Springwise. Springwise is the global ESG innovation platform that offers its readers early access to the ideas transforming our world. I actually started using Springwise probably 10 years ago to review innovative startup ideas, and I've been a fan ever since. There are three new stories on the site every weekday featuring solutions to some of the biggest challenges we face as a global community. You'll find innovations in climate tech, renewable energy, plastic alternatives, the circular economy, and how we can live a more sustainable life. The stories are sourced and written by the Springwise team of journalists and will give you an inspiring take on what's right around the corner, whether you read it to inform your work or simply for a regular dose of optimism. Springwise sets the innovation agenda. The newsletter is free to access, and to sign up, visit springwise.com/newsletter-signup.
Yeah, it's been really encouraging to see the founders that we have backed and the success that they've been able to create. And obviously, we're nothing without them, and their success is our success. And so, yeah, I feel really lucky to be backing some of the people that we've had the opportunity to back.
I sit down with Mike Winterfield, the founder of Active Impact, which is Canada's largest climate tech seed fund. Mike is a seasoned entrepreneur and dedicated advocate for environmental sustainability, with a career spanning over two decades across software, professional recruitment, and venture capital. Mike has continually demonstrated his commitment to making a positive impact. After roles as COO at Traction On Demand and president of Traction Rec, Mike founded Active Impact. Through Active Impact Investments, he channels his passion for the environment into profitable ventures, driving sustainable solutions while delivering returns. It's exciting to talk to someone with a lot of passion, but also a ton of business experience, and they get to see a lot of deals. We get to chat about what type of deals are getting attention and where they want to focus. We learn about climate companies that are doing well from a traction and growth perspective. We learn about how investors are responding to this market, among other things. Enjoy Mike's insights into environmental entrepreneurship and his unwavering commitment to a greener future. Mike, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Before we chat about Active Impact and founding this business and really kind of growing this to be Canada's largest climate tech seed fund, I would just like to take one quick step back. Did you foresee yourself being in a climate tech fund? Were you working on tough climate issues? Do you have an environmental journalism or environmental background in biology? What was your kind of background that led you to founding Active Impact?
Yeah, no, I'm not. I don't have environmental training or sort of deep technical experience. I suppose I've always been an environmentalist. I've always really had a passion for the outdoors and massive appreciation for nature and travel and kind of going on these adventures and being in touch with the elements. But I would say for me, it sort of just started with, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Is start off in your career, you need to make a bit of money, you're trying to learn how things work, you're trying to work your way up the totem pole. And at some point, purpose started becoming a more important word for me. I was wondering, you know, what would keep me interested in working much longer term. And at that same period of time, started learning a bunch of things that were happening with our climate, you know, whether it be starting off many, many years ago, almost 20 years ago, with Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and sort of how that was a bit of a wake-up call for some people, or some of the travel I was doing and seeing how certain cities in countries and environments had been negatively impacted. It just started jarring me a little bit. And I'd always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I was fascinated with sort of business and in commerce, but had started my career kind of working my way up through sort of sales organizations and helping other people build their businesses. And when it came time for me to say, well, I'd love to build my own business, then of course I had this beautiful intersection of I want to do something entrepreneurial and I want to do something with purpose. And so climate was sort of the top of my list. It just so happened I didn't know anything about venture capital. So I can come to that story later. But all that to say, I think it's important that people understand about me and about our company and our founding story is some people say, Mike, did you wake up one day and decide you want to be a venture capitalist? And I say, no, actually, venture capitalists do that. And then they try to decide what their thesis is going to be next. I was the exact opposite order. I decided that as a founder, I wanted to work on a problem that was important to me. And that problem was climate. And then the business that sort of emerged out of that, that started to make sense as a way that I would love to participate, actually became venture capital. So thesis chosen first and then vocation or type of startup. Because in a way, like we support startups, but we are also our own startup.
Yeah. And I think people sometimes forget about that as a venture company is they think about it's just venture capital, but it's a venture business as well that you have to build up from the beginning.
Yeah.
But like honing in, like that probably would have been, there's probably not a lot of companies doing that at the time. And there was some issues from, I think it's like the early 2000s when venture kind of went into what you know, kind of the first stage of real venture capital into environmental solutions, which arguably didn't go, some went well and a lot didn't go so well. So how did you kind of pinpoint on this idea that like, you know, we're going to really go all in on this kind of one sector. And obviously it's good for purpose, but how did you evaluate the business side of that as well to say, yes, this is actually also the right business to start?
Yeah, it feels so obvious now because there's been so much written now about impact investing, and climate investing has obviously really proliferated over the course of the last few years. But as hard as it might be to believe, even just 7 or 8 years ago, this was a pretty sort of nascent field. So I was one of the early followers and adopters of the B Corp movement, and a few years before that, reading a book called The New Capitalist Manifesto, and talking to some consultants that worked in this space that were basically sort of drawing attention to the fact that you could essentially have a quadrant when you're looking at businesses. There are businesses that positively impact humanity with what they do. There are businesses that negatively impact humanity with what you do. And some of those are run poorly and some of those are run well. And so in that upper right-hand quadrant, I just decided, well, this is what an amazing, if you have choice of where you're going to work or what you're going to work on, I mean, what an amazing place to work is in this one quadrant of, you know, a viable business, something that like really economically works. There's a big market need for it. But in addition to that, it's actually solving a problem for humanity. Wouldn't that be so much fun? And in a way, I was kind of hoping that this idea could almost go viral. Like not to suggest for one second that Mike Winterfield was person, you know, patient zero in this movement. There are obviously many people who went before me, and I'm thankful that they did because they showed me the way. But at least for me, it was kind of saying, okay, here's somebody who has had, you know, a 20-year career in business, has achieved some level of success and experience in doing that. But the businesses that I was contributing to, they solved the business problem. They didn't solve sort of a world problem, a people problem, a life problem. And what if I could just devote the rest of my career to applying all of my talent, my resources and network and so on to one of these other kinds of businesses? And if I was doing that, could I convince other people to do that? And if enough people did that, would that solve the climate crisis? And it was really kind of my hypothesis that it still is, that is probably what's needed. I mean, when I started off with sort of a general angst about climate that I think a lot of people suffer from right now, and I think of most of my friend group and very well-educated, very successful group of people, and it comes up at a dinner party and, oh, geez, did you hear about that? And yeah, that's pretty alarming. And then it's like immediately we're on to the next topic and they go back to what they do for their day-to-day, their living, their family, and it hasn't necessarily changed behavior in any way. And so I think the assumption in that case is like, okay, hopefully our government and other governments will just take care of this for us, or hopefully there's enough people donating money around these causes that there's some great not-for-profits that are going to take care of this for us. But I took the position that, unfortunately, I don't think that we can rely on just government and just not-for-profits to solve this issue. I think that there's a massive market opportunity to leverage capitalism and build businesses that both solve the problem and benefit from solving the problem. And that's really what we exist to do, is to try to motivate more really talented founders who have built amazing things and amazing teams and solved incredibly challenging problems in other domains to say, what if more of us migrated over and used that collective brain power and talent and networks to solve climate issues? And luckily it is a growing movement. It's a growing audience and some phenomenal founders that we get the great privilege to get a chance to work with and support.
Yeah. And you do hear a lot of people talk about, you know, capitalism is what kind of started this problem. And so maybe that's kind of why it's kind of been pushed to the side as a bit of a solution. But as you're showing, and the one thing that I've noticed, especially with this podcast and interviewing a lot of these founders as well, is I've never seen a group of people that resembles nonprofit founders as well. They are so incredibly mission driven, but at the same time, they're using business as a way to build it and hit markets. And not to say nonprofits aren't being impactful in the same space, they absolutely are as well. But you can do that. So prior to, you know, like an active impact, and like you said, like it seems a little bit more table stakes now, but before then, not a lot of people were doing it. How were people that are founders that were working on this kind of issue getting money? Was it governments that were funding this? Was it venture capitalists that were maybe focused on technology, but at the side of their desk, they would, you know, take a phone call and be like, oh, this is an interesting solar problem. Let's maybe invest in this as well on the side, but maybe just didn't have as much kind of focus and singularity in that space. Is that how it was kind of being served before?
I don't know. I would say that the best founders with the best business ideas have always been able to get funding. So for me, like I said, it was more about getting the right people working on this than it was that there were these incredible founders that were working on it and couldn't get funded. You know, it's sort of like it requires more of like a growth of the entire industry, the whole ecosystem, those that are supporting through accelerators and incubators for founders that have an idea that they want to figure out how to launch, and those that are providing early stage funding and Series A funding, Series B funding, Series C funding, growth stage funding, etc. funds that are able to raise money on that thesis that there will be companies that will succeed in doing this. So yeah, I don't know or don't think that it necessarily would have been that some of these folks wouldn't have been able to get funding before. It's just that's not how they would have necessarily marketed a business before. I mean, now it sort of has its own category, and climate tech having its own category means that it will attract a certain group of investors, and that there's pools of capital dedicated to supporting it, which is helpful. But if you look at the lens that we are looking through when we make these investments, it's important to note that we compete with funds that and investors that might not care about climate at all. They care solely about the financial performance of the business, and that's okay. Like we're okay to compete with those investors for the best deals and for scarce resources.
So you had this idea to go into this and build Active Impact. How did you kind of the high level overview of how did you get that started and off the ground? Was it just funding a deal or two yourself, or was it more of a like, we're gonna do this, we're gonna build this business, we're gonna get X amount of dollars for fund one, here's kind of an early look at some of the portfolios that we think we want to invest in? Like how did you go about from idea to kind of kicking it off?
I wish I could tell you that I had this very clear business plan with milestones in terms of what was possible to scale and what would be needed to scale, but I didn't, and we didn't. When I started off, the problem we were trying to solve was very important to me, and I knew we could remain consistent on that. How fast we could go, I didn't know. It was just apply pressure and put in a whole bunch of hustle to try to, at least I know I'm moving in the right direction, and let's see what can be accomplished with that. And so very specifically or tactically speaking, it started with, well, why do I think I might be able to be helpful? And so prior to venture capital, I didn't come from a finance background. I came from an operations background. I think I mentioned earlier, I sort of grew up through the sales organization of a couple different companies, ended up being the president of one company, COO of another company. And they were what I would describe as sort of mid-market companies. So while I was with these organizations, they were, or the portions of the organizations I was responsible for were kind of growing from the, you know, the $1 to $300 million a year in revenue range. And interesting companies, like ones I felt really privileged to have had an opportunity to work with. They were both market leaders in their own space. They were both, interestingly, ultimately private equity backed. Both of them ended up selling to a large publicly traded company. So interesting journey and kind of outcomes. But I watched M&As or took part in and helped with M&As and geographic expansions and product launches and just a bunch of interesting things that what I felt might be my ability to help was looking at startups and how resource deprived they are. They're resource deprived in a couple of ways. They're resource deprived, of course, financially. They're all working off of a very limited budgets. And the second way that they're resource deprived, and I think one that some investors think less about, is from a talent standpoint. Any early stage company has some pretty big gaping holes on their leadership team. And that just comes again back down to resources. You have to make intelligent decisions of what you can live without at a certain size and stage of company. And so I felt like I've been relatively successful in my career. I'm very comfortable leading sales organizations. That's one skill I know I can bring to bear. I had a lot of experience in sort of like the talent side of the business and building teams, identifying talent, and felt like, well, I've been paid pretty well to do that. And so which early stage companies out there can't afford to hire someone like me? And what if I could give them my time for free and almost operate as a fractional free executive resource to early stage companies? Could that make a difference? And so I just started off by volunteering and doing some work with accelerators and incubators. Worked with, you probably know Keith Hippel from Spring Activator, and Daryl got me involved with CEDL, Creative Destruction Lab, and a few others, and found out quickly, yeah, for sure, the founders appreciate getting help from people who've been there, done that. And then the second piece was, can I get investors to trust me to manage their money? And that was the harder part. So I knew I could provide value to the founders. Didn't know if I could raise money from investors. And so I, you know, without knowing a ton about how these funds were structured, I just told everybody I knew what my dream and my vision was. And some people I knew that had a little bit of money that they were willing to put at risk. Very fortunately for me, some of them did. Some of them knew me as a friend or a past business colleague and said, you know, I trust Mike, and I know he'll work hard to try to make this work. Whether it will work or not, I don't know, but I trust that he will at least do that. And we managed to cobble together a little bit of money. And then as I added people to the team, those people that I added to the team brought more credibility, more expertise, and their own networks. And eventually we were able to sort of cobble together enough money to do a first fund. And then with the first fund, you use that obviously to demonstrate your capabilities, and that allows you to scale and raise, you know, a second fund. And if second fund goes well, you raise a third fund, and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, we're now on a third fund. But going all the way back to your initial question, it really did happen quite organically with, I want to help founders that have these ideas to be able to solve the climate crisis, and how can I help to attract some capital so that I can sort of step in and be a fractional resource for them. And venture capital turned out to be a good model to do that, that everybody understood how it worked.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review.
And I think you had mentioned it earlier too, is that sometimes and often you'll compete with, you know, venture capital that have nothing to do with climate, but they're just you know, looking for really good businesses. And so I wanted to kind of get to that part of the portfolio companies around how you look at that between impact versus actual business and the two sides of it. Because, you know, you have a vision, obviously, to be impactful. And the impact there is really success of those businesses so that they can keep doing what they do. And how do you balance that? And I guess, how do you look at it differently than how other venture capital will look in terms of the business models and that side of it? Because I think a lot of people are curious about that. Is like, just because you're a business that's trying to build something that's better for the planet, you still need to be a good business. And you said, like, these ones would have figured out how to get resources and money if they needed it because they were good ideas and good businesses. But like, is there any differences between the cohorts of portfolios that you look at versus maybe a different type of venture group? Or how have you seen that kind of differentiate itself?
You said something in your question that we believe strongly in, which is actually that the size of the impact is directly correlated to the potential size and success and outcome of the business. You said something of that nature. And that's an important distinction, because it's not how all people view the market, and all funds are different, right? So there are impact funds out there that have such a different thesis than us. And I'm glad that they exist. And I'm glad that there's investors that want to support them. And I'm glad that those founders get support from a different group of people. But, you know, for instance, there are some funds out there that are what they call concessionary return funds. And so in some concessionary return funds, the way that they're deploying capital is basically to say, let me find founders that can't get money from traditional sources, and let me find a way to support them in a unique way. So finding investors that are okay with a much higher degree of risk. And in fact, that, you know, quite possible that it would return, and they're even actually targeting below market returns. And so when we set out to build our fund, we had a conversation about this very early on. We said, who do we want to be? Do we want to be a concessionary return fund? Do we want to be a market return fund? Or do we want to try to compete with all venture capital firms globally to try to be a top ranked financial performer? And what we landed on for a variety of reasons is that we wanted to become a top ranked fund. And I guess I'll share a couple of those with you very, very quickly. One was, our belief was that, again, to create the size of the impact that we want to create, it's only going to be created if these companies go on to reach a massive scale. And the only way they'll ever be able to reach a massive scale is that they've been a huge financial success, right? So it's like, it's that financial sustainability that differentiates the scale that's possible for the for-profit versus the not-for-profit, because you don't have to you don't have to have your hand out to ask for money. You're not limited by people's level of generosity. You can leverage greed if you want. You're building a business that provides a return on investment for their customers. It saves time, save money, whatever they do that makes their product or service worth purchasing. And in a way that creates sort of like this infinite path to scale, where the revenue is the fuel and allows this unlimited scale if you've got your numbers right. So first thing we decided was, okay, we want to be able to hit that level of scale. And so we're going to have to go after the ones that can be massive financial successes and winners. And then the second one was, we looked at what kinds of businesses do we have experience selecting and running, and they were all for-profit businesses that were trying to be market leaders. So that was where we thought that we could apply our skills most. And then we looked at it from the sort of the product side. If you're building a venture capital product and people have a choice of one product or another, and we felt like building a high-performing fund where people didn't have to choose to do the right thing actually increased the size of the impact market. So imagine there was a whole bunch of concessionary return funds, and they're all competing for a finite number of dollars that have been allocated to impact, which a lot of large investors will do, by the way. They'll say, I'll take 2% of my portfolio and I'll allocate it to impact. Question is, do you want to be confined to just that 2% that's been allocated to impact? Or would you rather the opportunity to go after their allocation to venture capital, which might be a much larger number? They might say, of my entire portfolio, I'm carving out 10% that's going to get deployed into venture capital. We'd rather obviously go after the 10 than the one or two. And by doing so, it means that we didn't take the opportunity away from another fund in the one or two that was dedicated to impact, where there's only a certain number of managers that can get supported. We hopefully brought somebody over that was allocating capital and said, we think Active Impact can make money. We think that their thesis is good. We think their team is good. We think they pick good companies. I've never really thought that much about climate or cared that much about climate, but I think they're going to make me money. Well, that means we just expanded the size of the pie in terms of those that are investing in climate, because they wouldn't have invested in climate and they didn't actually in a way choose to invest in climate. They chose to invest in good returns, but we drove the benefit of the fact that that money then got directed to climate.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's obviously a very kind of key distinction in kind of honing in on that in that type of market. And so, you know, now that, you know, you are into fund one, fund two, and looking into fund three, you know, you talk a lot about obviously performance. And so you're starting to get that data coming back now because of time and early funds. How is that performance looking for this kind of group of portfolio companies?
It's been really good. I mean, I don't know what I'm allowed to talk about publicly, or I would say I'm careful to talk about publicly just because there are lots of rules out there with the financial regulators in Canada. Canada and the US. But yeah, I mean, we have been well above market returns. We have invested now in 35 companies across the three funds, and we've had no failed startups yet, which is, I think, really shocking to a lot of people, given that we do seed, stage, and pre-seed, which is kind of understood to be the riskiest levels of investing. But yeah, we get measured against other funds on things like, you know, the size of our fund or a thesis or a vintage year. And if you look at size of fund and vintage year, I think our first fund is a top quartile performing fund. We've been able to sell four of our companies now. We have offers on the table right now for a couple more. So we've had some realized returns. Yeah, it's been really encouraging to see the founders that we have backed and the success that they've been able to create. And obviously we're nothing without them, and their success is our success. And so yeah, feel really lucky to be backing some of the people that we've had the opportunity to back.
Yeah, and that's how we connected too. We've had, I believe, at least three portfolio companies of yours on the show, from Chop Value, Solstice, as well as Future. And you could tell they're very, very passionate entrepreneurs. So how, you know, you've built a brand for yourself, right? And like you said, you've built this business as well. And Active Impact is a known fund, which you've obviously done a good job branding and building. And I think it probably goes back to how you probably supported your entrepreneurs and how you've been able to work with these portfolio companies as well to do that. But have you seen an increase in pitches as well? Because I think that's the one thing that I think a lot of people, you talk about, you know, we hope that the governments are doing things and stuff, but we also hope that lots of entrepreneurs are building the next new business that might change this kind of course that we're on. So are you still seeing that kind of level of energy? Are you seeing more deals come across your desk, more entrepreneurs getting into this space? Like, how are you feeling about the next kind of 5-10 years with entrepreneurs kind of pitching you this next kind of good idea?
It's getting better and it's getting easier. I mean, thank you for saying that we've done a good job of building our brand. I suppose, like many others, are probably a little bit self-critical. And I would say there are some areas that I'm proud of how we've built our brand. I think we've gotten to be relatively well-known and well-liked in Canada. I think we've done a poor job probably of getting our brand known across borders in the US or Europe and Asia. So I think we've got some work to do to get to become globally recognized. But I think nationally, I feel good about how we position ourselves. I think that our brand has been strong in terms of people recognizing what is core for us and knowing the connection to climate and some of the thought leadership that we put out in terms of climate, and knowing that we focus on early stage. But I think one thing that's going to be important for us from a brand standpoint is that what we think that we're really good at, where we think that we are differentiated from other funds, that it's not what we tell people, it's what other people say about us. And I would say our founders say it about us, our investors say it about us. So that's a good starting point, is that there's external stakeholders that when we look in the mirror, we see something similar to what we're trying to kind of put out there. But the next step of success for a brand, I think, would be that people that are not in our inside our four walls, or that are not our investors, or that are not our founders, would describe what we stand for or what we're good at, where we have edge, back to other people in the market and say, you know, I would want Active Impact as an investor on my cap table because I know they're very good at this. And so I think we still have some work to do there. But to your specific question around deal flow, yeah, it goes up every year, right? So I would say we have the Canadian market very, very mapped out. It would be unusual for us to hear about a financing that happens at pre-seed or seed that we were not familiar with, or haven't at some point met or spoken to the founder or seen them pitch or had somebody share their deck with us or be tracking them in some way. And we're working on that coverage, like I said, in the US as well. And I would say through deal partners in the US, we feel like we have the US relatively well covered. It's a little bit harder when you don't have somebody in market on the ground. So that could be something that we look at for the future. But yeah, deal flow has grown every year. It's extremely strong. When I have friends or family that say to me, like, how's the business going? I'd say we have no shortage of phenomenal founders that we would love to back. We have no shortage of incredible talent that wants to come and work at Active Impact. And so you would rightfully ask, well, okay, so what is the barrier to scale? The barrier to scale is usually the capital raising side, right? It's been a really tough environment to do that for the last couple of years for most funds. We got very lucky with, we've already raised the majority of our third fund late last year, but yeah, definitely required speaking to way more investors than in prior years, just to find people who had budget and allocation to VC, because that changes through the ups and downs in the market. And then just real quick to finish off, one other part of your question, which was like, how do we feel about the next 5 or 10 years? I couldn't be more bullish, right? Like the next 5 or 10 years, we really truly feel like we're at these massive tipping points, and there are just so many tailwinds that are pushing us in the right direction that will help founders that choose to go into climate to succeed, from attracting talent, from regulatory tailwinds, from attracting funding, to consumer and business purchasing choices, to like the list goes on. But yeah, we're really, really excited about the next 5 to 10 years.
I think the entrepreneurs listening here would probably be pulling on my jacket if I didn't just ask you this question, just because when you think about kind of a bit more of just like overarching themes or maybe kind of categories that you're looking at in the next kind of 5, 10 years that you see potential growth in, you know, if that means certain tech in certain areas or certain markets, what are you thinking of, and where are you seeing potential kind of growth in that you know, we talk about broad climate, but is there anything kind of niche more so that you're thinking of that's really interesting?
We have a list of those things for sure as a team, where we've done a deeper dive, and we do these sessions called Thesis Fridays, where we sort of try to set aside the day-to-day and meetings and allow the investment team to go really deep. And so they've definitely identified areas where we want to have the prepared mind and to look for opportunities. But I would say that what we are much more receptive to is just being on a path of continuous learning and opportunity and remaining curious and watching how fast the world is changing right now, and trying not to get stuck on old paradigms, being ready for that founder that comes in and has seen the world in a way that we haven't seen it before, and has thought of an idea and where they believe the market is going and the market's ready for. And so I would say maybe something that would surprise you or that surprises other people is just how often we are pleasantly surprised with somebody else coming to us. And even though we feel quite well educated and informed on climate and a lot of the drivers, but the number of times that a founder will come in and pitch us and sort of describe the GHG emission impact of a particular sector, of a particular industry, and have a novel way of approaching it. And for us, novel typically means like market ready, like the customers would adopt and pay for this now because it creates economic benefit for them, not because they're being forced to pay some sort of green premium or they're being forced into it to do the right thing. We get pleasantly surprised every week with amazing new ideas. And I would say that's something that we as a team want to try to embrace and remain open to for the next decade. Is you run the risk that the more you get to know a particular area, that you start doing pattern matching and saying, no, we've looked at 10 companies that have tried to deal with, you know, circular plastic solutions and, you know, none of them work and they don't scale and it's, you know, it's too inefficient, it's too expensive and there's too much disruption to supply chains. And yeah, but what about when that one founder walks in the door and tells you that they have found a way to overcome all of the problems that you have seen with every business model you've seen until now? That's what's exciting.
Yeah. And for the handful of founders that I've met that Active is part of, I'd say that you've chosen really good founders. And obviously that kind of showcases through your portfolio is picking the right people with the right mission, with the right idea. And obviously it's working. So Mike, thanks so much for joining us. How can people learn a little bit more about Active Impact and yourself?
Thanks again for having me. And yeah, our website is activeimpactinvestments.com. And we'd love to hear from people. We also have a LinkedIn channel that we put out a lot of recent news. And we also have a newsletter that you can subscribe to off of our website.
I'm sure the entrepreneurs and investors alike are really excited to kind of listen to your story and how you built it. And congrats for all the success and looking forward to following your story into the future.
Thanks, Marco.
Having Mike from Active Impact Investments, like, I think it was incredibly curious to hear, and is that they really look for just good businesses. They need big returns, and they need the returns to hit market. And he kind of dives into how they look at and where they want to be in the market. And they want to be in a market where people are looking for returns. And if those returns just happen to enable a business that's good for our planet and that is bringing to market a good solution, that's just plain good business. I think the other like really interesting takeaway from this too was that Mike had a pretty unique perspective on categorization. I thought for sure he was going to be able to talk about they're honing in on carbon offsetting or they're going all in on, you know, food waste solutions, but he really didn't touch on that. He said they're looking for really great businesses with really, really, really strong founders. And if those strong founders are there, they don't want to be narrowed in. So I thought that was really, really interesting to note, is that they're really looking for that next idea. They don't want to hone in on any category. And that's, I'd say, is kind of an interesting take and one that I haven't really seen, not that I haven't seen before, but often they do get verticalized, and there really was no kind of call out on verticalization. The other part with Mike is we thought, is Mike must have been a venture capitalist. And I think, you know, that's further from the truth. What's funny is, and ironic, is how he thinks of these portfolio companies. He wants them to be good businesses that are scalable, but they're impactful, but that they're financially sound. It's the same thing the way that he looks at Active Impact. And Active Impact is being impactful, is purpose-led, but at the same time, they're bringing returns and they're bringing in new investors to be able to do that. So yeah, the whole episode was just a really interesting take on his view. Just an awesome, great episode. I think entrepreneurs are going to really take away that there's a ton of growth. Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please share it. And also, don't forget, subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review.